from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, last month the National Football League and retired players and their families agreed to a $765 million settlement over concussion-related lawsuits. The suit has focused public attention on head injuries in all levels of football and many other sports. And we'll discuss the prevention and treatment of sports-related concussions and explore some new research. That's up next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The National Football League's settlement with retired players who said they had developed brain disorders caused by concussions has brought a heightened attention to concussions, a type of traumatic brain injury typically caused by a bump, blow, or jolt to the head, or a blow to the body that causes the head and brain to move rapidly back and forth. Roughly 1.7 million people in the United States are treated for a head injury each year, and some 80% or more of those are mild concussions that heal with rest. But many people do not even know they have concussions because the symptoms can be vague, and the number of concussions of young athletes has been going up at such an alarming rate that the Center for Disease Control is calling it an epidemic, a 60% increase in the number of traumatic brain injuries treated between 2001 and 2009. This Forum Hour, we discuss concussions, prevention and treatment, and some of the new research, and let me tell you who is joining us. Eric Freitag is here in studio with us. He's co-founder of the California Concussion Coalition. He's a board-certified neuropsychologist and executive director of the Montdiablo Memory Center Sports Concussion Program. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Carla Center. Carlin Center is primary care sports medicine physician with UCSF's Concussion and Head Injury Program, and she's a team physician for Washington High School in San Francisco, for Redwood High School in Marin, and for the University of San Francisco. And welcome, Carlin Center.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. We'll also say good morning to Pratik Mukherjee, who is professor of radiology at the University of California, San Francisco, and who also joins us by phone this morning. Good to have you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Let me begin with Eric Freitag, who, as I said, is here in studio with us. And it's kind of hard to define concussion, but in sort of studying up on it, I learned some things that may at least demythologize and tell us what it's not. For example, you don't need to pass out. And moreover, wearing a helmet isn't necessarily going to protect you. I mean, these are important points to make right off the top. But How do you find it when there's no real diagnostic tools? I mean, we'll find out about some of the new research and electronics in this, but how do you go about diagnosing?
Well, it is challenging. A clinical diagnosis of a concussion is basically made retrospectively, where we have to talk with the athlete and find out what happened. You know, first of all, was there a mechanism of injury? Did they have a blow to the head or to the body? And then secondly, did they experience some changes in the way that their brain normally functions? And those changes are usually felt by symptoms. You know, did they have a headache? Did they feel out of it? Dazed? Did they have blurred vision, balance problems, different neurological symptoms? And then there's also cognitive symptoms. You know, were they feeling foggy? Were they having memory problems, difficulties concentrating and focusing? And those are the symptoms that the athlete would report. And it's also important to observe the athlete because there's also some signs that they might display. You know, they're maybe unsteady on their feet. They're acting a little slower. They're not able to remember the play. So when you interview the athlete, it's important to get not only their report of what happened, but recognizing they may not even remember everything that happened, but also talking to the parents or coaches who might have been on the sideline watching the game.
But no diagnostic test, no biomarker, no objective way to really find it?
Not yet. Biomarkers are an interesting area of study, and I think the next few years there's going to be some interesting things coming out that may help us clarify and enhance our diagnosis.
You do impact tests as a psychologist, though, and they're fairly comprehensive. What do you do?
Well, the impact test, first and foremost, it's not a diagnostic tool. It is a way for us to manage the injury, to evaluate an athlete's cognitive or brain functions after the concussion diagnosis has been made. And it It's a cognitive screening. So it's about a 25, 30-minute test that allows us to look at aspects of memory, reaction time, processing speed, common areas of brain function that can be affected after a concussion.
We are going to talk, as I said, with Carlin Center, primary care sports medicine physician, and Pratik Mukherjee, who's professor of radiology. First, I want to bring Nate Jackson, because Nate Jackson is a former NFL player, and as I said, the NFL settlement has brought greater attention to this. He spent 6 years in the league, mostly playing as a receiver with the Denver Broncos, as a tight end, excuse me, and he's a local. He's a graduate of Pioneer High School in San Jose and played for Menlo College in Atherton, and has a book out called Slow Getting Up, a story of NFL survival from the bottom of the pile. And Nate, we should mention right up front here that you were not part of this lawsuit.
Correct, I was not. I was recruited to be part of the lawsuit, but I declined that.
Well, tell us about what you were affected by in the way of concussion or what you experienced.
Well, it's difficult. It's difficult to explain that because from a very early age, I think the first injury I ever had in high school was a concussion. I was a freshman in high school, and I was hit really, really hard in practice, and I had concussion-like symptoms for that following week. I was held out of practice, and then the next week I was back at it again. I probably didn't get another concussion in high school, maybe another one in college, and a few more in the pro. But as I went through football, I learned very quickly that pain, no matter where it was on your body or in your head, was kept to yourself. And so diagnosing it becomes really hard. If you have to have a conversation with the athlete to diagnose it, it's going to be difficult, but because the athlete keeps the pain in. Football is a tough guy sport where you don't tell anybody when you're hurt. You don't tell anybody you have a headache.
You got to get back on the field.
Yeah, you got to get back on the field, especially in professional football, because there are guys behind you waiting to get on the field if you can. And there are guys at home at the game who have been working out and are waiting for that call. So if you can't go, then someone else will. And so guys really just keep it to themselves.
And what are you hearing from, say, NFL colleagues about the long-term effects of their concussions?
I don't hear much. It's a strange environment. When you play in the NFL, you're really close with all the guys, you see them all the time, you're going through the same things. But then when you're cut and when you're done, everyone scatters, and I really don't talk to many of my former teammates anymore. There are a few who I do keep in contact with. I am aware that some of my former teammates are having some memory issues, some depression, some problems feeling motivated, finding things that stimulate them. And these are just guys in their 30s and early 40s. As far as the old timers go, the 50s and 60s, I think they're running into some problems too.
So what did you think of the proposed National Football League lawsuit settlement, and what do you think should be done?
I think it's a difficult PR game that the NFL is engaged in. They have a really very profitable product on their hands, but as the science catches up with the game, it's becoming apparent it's really, really bad for the brains of the men playing it. And so they're caught in a difficult situation, and I think this settlement was their way of making it go away for a few more years or however long it's going to take for it to resurface again. But I don't think that the $765 million is – it's hard to tell what that number really means, because there are a lot of retired football players out there. Apparently, they all have access to this money, but they have to go through extensive cognitive tests and getting guys, NFL former guys, guys who are really have a lot of pride and are stubborn, to go do all these tests and go through the process of getting these payouts. It's just going to be a hairy situation, and I don't know if it'll play out. I don't know how it'll play out, but there's a lot of nuance to it that it's really hard for me to pinpoint.
Nate Jackson, again, played 6 years in the National Football League and mostly as a tight end with the Denver Broncos. Local, actually played for Menlo College in Atherton, and is the author of a new book called Slow Getting Up, a story of NFL survival from the bottom of the pile. And we should also mention that you were signed initially by the 49ers, but got waived, so there's even more of a local connection. Good luck to you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We're going to actually talk next with Carlin Center, who's primary care sports medicine physician for UCSF and concussion and head injury program there, team physician for Washington High School, San Francisco, Redwood High School in Marin, and University of San Francisco. And Dr. Senter, with this greater awareness, particularly in light of the NFL lawsuit, I imagine you're seeing a lot more care and concern about kids getting concussions, aren't you?
We definitely are. I think most physicians are seeing more kids and adults coming in with concern for concussion in our clinics.
And there's also a sense that probably historically, even though we don't know how to diagnose it, it was dramatically underdiagnosed. How do we know that?
So there are good studies looking at that, particularly an interesting one from, I think, the mid-2000s. A bunch of high schoolers in Minnesota were quizzed after their football season, and they were asked, well, did you have these symptoms, you know, classic concussion symptoms that Dr. Freitag mentioned? And the kids, you know, owned up to having these symptoms. And then they said, well, how many of you were diagnosed with a concussion? And only about 50% of those kids had been diagnosed formally with a concussion. And so we do think concussion historically has been really underdiagnosed. The interesting thing about that study is they followed up with a question to the kids, well, how come you weren't diagnosed? I think most of us think, well, they probably, you know, didn't want to tell anyone about their symptoms. And that's true for some of those kids, I think about a third of them, but actually 60% of them weren't aware that their symptoms were concerning for concussion.
Well, we're going to talk later on with a cyclist, and I mentioned that because I had said kids, and yet the concern for all sports, for kids and adults where concussions are concerned, is inclusive. But kids and teens in some ways are even more vulnerable, are they not, because of the brain development and they're different biomechanically. You know, the head is disproportionately bigger than the body.
Certainly. We do think that it may be that kids take longer to get better than adults from concussion. That data is a little bit controversial, but the early data on that shows that kids may take longer actually to recover. And those of us who see concussion tend to be more conservative in our care of the younger the child because the brain is developing.
Well, it's hard with kids, too. I mean, you know, the best thing for a concussion or even the suspicion of a concussion is rest, rest, rest. And yet, you know, kids don't like to be inactive.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, you know, not infrequently I feel like I'm sort of grounding, you know, the high schooler because the instructions are cognitive and physical rest, including, you know, minimize the screen time, try to avoid texting, video games, not too much stimulation with friends. So the rest is sometimes a difficult prescription to give for a student athlete who's used to running at, you know, 300% speed.
We also don't know how long these effects last, and that's another really worrisome thing. I mean, when we were talking to Nate Jackson, I was reminded of the fact that there's, with a lot of these NFL players, perhaps even more of a risk of dementia and Alzheimer's, at least that's what some of the research points to. But we don't know how long-term, especially where youth are concerned, the effects are, do we?
We don't know. Definitely we're in need of prospective studies on this. I think the concern is, for sure, the association between dementia and playing NFL football, and that has really driven this increased concern and increased caution about how we're treating concussion.
Let me go to Pratik Mukherjee, who again is professor of radiology at University of California, San Francisco. I know we're seeing some inroads in technology here, Dr. Mukherjee, but I'd like to just get your take on, what's happening with brain imaging and how it's used, CAT scans and MRIs and the like. I mean, I know we can see some contusions and lesions with these scans and even some microhemorrhages. So there's a possibility, really, is there not, of maybe moving more toward diagnosis?
Yes, I believe so. So traditionally, concussion has been thought of as a head trauma but normal imaging. And some people use that to distinguish it from the term mild traumatic brain injury. But increasingly, the distinction between concussion and mild traumatic brain injury is being blurred. And as our imaging tools become more sensitive, these scans are picking up abnormalities in people with a clinical diagnosis of concussion. And certainly, we've seen that in the patients that Carlin has been seeing in her clinic. And so CT, CAT scans, are usually normal in these concussion patients. But if you go on to MRI, our MRI technology has been getting increasingly better. And if you do a protocol that's optimized for detecting the types of abnormalities you might see in concussion patients or mild traumatic brain injury patients, namely bruising on the brain, what we call contusions, which may be scarred down if the scan is done weeks or months after the injury and the patient is having persistent symptoms, which would be the reason for getting the scan, or these sometimes with white matter injury, which is due to rotational forces on the brain after trauma. We're seeing these, as you refer to, microhemorrhages or microbleeds. So our most recent generation of scanners is becoming, MRI scanners, becoming increasingly sensitive to these subtle abnormalities. So not all MRI scanners are created equal. The newer generation, the so-called 3-Tesla scanners, have stronger magnetic fields and are capable of producing sharper images. It's like the difference between a regular TV and a HD TV. So with these higher definition scans, we're picking up subtle abnormalities that we previously couldn't see before. And we're doing outcome assessments in these patients and finding that these subtle abnormalities are, in fact, associated with disability longer term and abnormal neurocognitive and neuropsychological outcomes.
Pratik Mukherjee, again, is professor of radiology at University of California, San Francisco. It also allows you to tailor treatments more toward patients, whether it's cognitive therapy or antidepressants, or, in fact, I was reading sometimes video games.
Absolutely. There's been certainly a lot of press about that recently from work done at UCSF for older adults to stave off cognitive.
We did a program on it with...
right.
Yeah.
So the same sorts of techniques might be useful in mild traumatic brain injury / concussion as well. Certainly, as Dr. Freytag referred to, the types of cognitive abnormalities like a lack of attentional focus, lack of memory, are similar to what older adults experience, especially if they have incipient neurodegenerative disorders.
Can you talk a bit about post-concussive syndrome, which, again, is something that we know more about than we did a while back?
Sure. So with post-concussive syndrome, I mean, that's something that is commonly experienced acutely after a concussion, like within the first days, 2 weeks. The majority of patients recover from the standpoint of those symptoms mostly going away, but a significant minority, and if you look at different studies, the percentage is typically between 15% and 30% of patients with concussions will continue to experience these symptoms and sometimes disability associated with them for months or even years after the injury. And that's what we call persistent post-concussive syndrome. And that's what we're really trying to find better biomarkers for, whether they be imaging biomarkers such as from CT and MRI scans, mostly MRI nowadays, or whether they be blood biomarkers that you could detect from a blood sample and so forth.
Pratik Mukherjee is professor of radiology at UCSF, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
Good to have you on. And we'll continue with Dr. Freytag and Dr. Santer. And in fact, Eric Freytag, when I was talking about rest, you were sort of making a hand motion that suggested, well, maybe not, or something along those lines. But I thought, when in doubt, sit it out. Isn't that the rule?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think if one thing your listeners take home from today's program is that if there is a suspected concussion, that the athlete does not return to play until they're cleared by a medical professional with training and experience in concussion management. I think what we're finding, though, and I think Dr. Center would agree, is that, yeah, rest is very important, especially in the acute period, the first few days after an injury. But then after that point, once the symptoms start to decline and settle down a little bit, we can't keep resting the athlete until all symptoms go away. Because what happens if you take a kid who's, you know, doing sports every day and, you know, activities with their friends, and all of a sudden we just shut them down for the next 4 weeks and have them do nothing? Well, they're going to have symptoms of depression and fatigue and lethargy. And a lot of those symptoms can be mistaken for a concussion. But when in actuality, it's a little bit of depression setting in because they're so bored and understimulated. So what we find is that when we manage these athletes, we want to rest them. Definitely, we want to cut down their activities, but once those symptoms settle down, slowly start introducing them back into some activities, including some mild physical exertion, some mild mental exertion, to get their brains activated again, to get them back into life. And we find that that actually helps to get them back to their activities more quickly, rather than just the old method of shutting them down completely until every symptom goes away.
Well, Carl and Center, I know you can't really predict recovery time, but if I'm not mistaken, the first 10 days after are the highest risk, are they not?
That's what's been found in studies, both animal studies and sort of following people over time, is that, you know, there's this cascade of abnormal events that occurs on a cellular level in the brain. And that cascade, we think, occurs in sort of the first, you know, week to 11 days after the injury. And as Eric was saying, you know, we definitely see symptom resolution often within that period of time. And then corresponding, we think, with what's happening at a cellular level, people kind of are ready to, you know, re-engage and gradually get back into activities.
But there's a danger in not tending to or mismanaging. I mean, we've been saying that again. It's an important takeaway from this hour. So if you're working with a young athlete who falls on his head or her head or something along those lines, has a body jerk that presents symptoms, I guess the ruling ought to be, I mean, for parents as well as for coaches, I mean, take them out immediately, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, like the CDC says, if in doubt, sit them out. You know, until someone like a certified athletic trainer can take a look on the sideline. I think it's a huge benefit of having an athletic trainer at a high school is that they have expertise in concussion diagnosis and even treatment. And so having someone on the front lines at the high school level is super helpful to sort those things out in real time. But I think if a coach or a parent has any question, then the safest thing is to wait and, you know, see their doctor.
We keep hearing about football. I want to mention, well, I did before, that almost all sports have the possibility of concussions. But where do we see the highest numbers? Do either of you know other than football?
Well,
professionally or even an amateur, they're different, I'm sure. Yeah.
Well, your contact and collision sports are going to have the highest incidence. So football, of course, hockey, lacrosse, sports like rugby, those tend to have higher incidence of concussions. But it's important to remember that really it can happen in all sports. So other contact sports like basketball and soccer, of course, has a lot of higher incidence of concussions. But I've seen a rower before who got hit in the head with an oar, or divers who hit their head on the diving board. So it does happen, in all sport activities. And, of course, not just in sports, but in general activities that kids are involved in, bike riding, skateboarding, and even just playing on the playground.
And again, the mythology says, boy, if you got a helmet, you know, that's going to protect you. And it just is not the case in so many cases of these concussions. We're talking about concussions in light of the lawsuit last month with the NFL and retired players and their families agreeing to a $765 million settlement over concussion-related lawsuits, and a lot of focusing of attention now on head injuries in all levels of football and many other sports. So we're discussing prevention, treatment of sports-related concussions. You may have questions and you may want to join us. And in fact, here's an opportunity to do just that. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls. You may talk about some of your own experiences, and you may indeed want to bring those to bear as well. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us. Email address is forum@kqed.org. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And for more on concussion in sports, there's a special frontline program, League of Denial, the NFL's Concussion Crisis. It airs on Tuesday, October 8th. At 9 p.m. on KQED Public Television 9. And on Thursday, October 17th, you can join KQED for a screening of the Frontline special, followed by a panel discussion with Bay Area experts and former National Football League players. That event will be held from 6 to 9 at Kaiser Center, 300 Lakeside Drive in Oakland. In the meantime, we'll continue with Eric Freitag, co-founder of California Concussion Coalition, and Carlin Center, who is a primary care sports physician with UCSF and a team physician for a number of schools. And when we come back, we'll hear from you as well. We also spoke with Nate Jackson, a former NFL player, and Pratik Mukherjee, a professor of radiology at UCSF. And as I say, we'll get you involved when we return after a brief break. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, we're talking about sports-related concussions, but just concussions in general in this hour, and some of the new research, as well as prevention and treatment. We had Pratik Mukherjee with us earlier, professor of radiology at UCSF, and Nate Jackson, a former NFL player, and Eric Freitag is here with us in studio, co-founder of the California Concussion Coalition and a board-certified neuropsychologist. He's executive director of the Monte Diablo Memory Center Sports Concussion Program. And Carlin Center is also with us, primary care sports medicine physician at UCSF and with the Concussion Head Injury Program there. She's also team physician for Washington High School in San Francisco, for Redwood High School in Marin, and for the University of San Francisco. And we're going to go to your calls and emails and web postings in just a moment here. We wanted to check in, though, with Allison Tetrick, who's a professional cyclist, and she was also an Olympic hopeful and has been on the U.S. international team. She's based in Mill Valley. She suffered three race-related concussions in a span of just 18 months. And Allison Tetrick, good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Three races, that's a lot. I mean, three concussions in a year and a half. Talk about the effect it had on you.
It taught me some valuable lessons. I think we get out on our bikes and you feel invincible or anything we do in life. And I think a hard lesson I had to learn that, you know, I'm definitely not invincible and I'm not a superhero. and it was pretty traumatizing for me. One of the concussions definitely having some TBI symptoms and really learning how to regain control, heal my brain. When you look normal on the outside and on the inside, you are far from healed.
Well, you now have clearance to race again, and so that's a happy ending. But there's also a big lesson for you, or wasn't there, in terms of just not rushing it?
Exactly. I did work with Dr. Freitag and the Mount Diablo Memory Center, and really was encouraged by him to take some time off and let myself heal. And as an athlete, that's very difficult at any level because we're always looking to get back out there. But really allowing your brain to recover, taking a more realistic approach to where you are in your healing and what your abilities are. I struggled with a lot of inability to read, focus, sleep, went through depression and a lot of other symptoms that was quite a struggle.
But you're okay now for the most part, and you're cycling still.
I am cycling still. I am healing, yes. I am still not probably the same as I was. However, it has inspired me to continue to pursue not only the sport of cycling, to raise awareness about the dangers of concussions in cycling, since that sport's a little different without a penalty box or a sideline that you can take a time out in. Cycling, you have to keep doing the race to finish. And also, I've just been applying to grad school to pursue a doctorate in neuropsychology like Dr. Freitag. So, It is indeed happier.
Well, and you say you don't feel invincible anymore, but there must be some fear when you're cycling. I mean, just the possibility of a fourth concussion or another concussion.
There's a lot of fear, and that doesn't make me the best cyclist always, because I definitely have a very high respect for the pavement, the speeds I'm racing and just riding in, and also the symptoms that could occur if I did hit the ground. So I think I need to be able to weigh those risks and rewards accordingly.
Well, good luck, and I hope you continue to compete with, if not invincibility, at least good health. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Eric, is it Freitag or Freitag? I've heard both this hour.
Either one is fine.
You've given up.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to get our callers involved in this, but talk about this California Concussion Coalition, could you?
Certainly. Just incidentally, Allison is actually an advisory member to the coalition. It's a program that I started with Dr. Cindy Chang. She's a primary care sports medicine physician like Dr. Center, a UC Berkeley a physician, and also the chief medical officer for the 2012 U.S. Olympic team. And so her and I felt there was a real need to educate the community. We recognize that if coaches, parents, administrators, and the athletes themselves have some basic understanding about how to properly identify, respond to, and manage concussion injuries, we find that by the time they get to our office, they're doing so much better. Because really the treatment of a concussion or the management of a concussion begins right when it occurs on the sideline or on the field. And how the adults respond to that injury can really set the stage and facilitate a recovery to occur much more quickly, rather than not being aware of the signs and symptoms and putting them back on the field or not reducing activity sufficiently enough. So we find through education, first and foremost, that it can really change the outcomes for a lot of these injuries.
Let's bring in our callers, and we go up to Santa Rosa for the first call. John, you're on. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wondered if your panelists could comment on the pre-testing that some schools are requiring for their student athletes involved in contact sports, is it going to help with the assessment and the rehabilitation of these student athletes should they have a head injury?
Yeah, Dr. Center.
So the pre-testing is often a computerized neuropsychological test, such as IMPACT. Both Dr. Freitag and I administer such things sort of on an as-needed basis for teams and individuals. I think we both, well, I won't speak for you, Eric, but personally find it, you know, to be a useful tool if the athlete has a concussion to have a baseline. You know, I think it's a reasonable thing for student athletes who are in higher risk collision or contact sports to do. Is it critical? No. Is it a necessity? No. You know, I think the majority of concussion cases that I see in the office don't have a baseline, and we can certainly treat concussion either way.
And let me thank the caller and move right along to more of your calls. We'll go to Shell next in San Lorenzo. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I've heard various people speak on the issue, and a rugby player was saying they're very competitive, and if you see stars, you don't want to be out of the game. And I'm thinking that the desires, when they're big enough, it kind of becomes a culture. And the helmets that have been improved, they tend to, according to some people, just result in pushing the envelope. And that the kids should be taught early that if you're not going to be taken off the team if you tell the coach that you have had an experience, and any experience that may be a concussion should be immediately told to the coach. And
I'm sorry, but I'm struck by what you're saying, because I think the culture has a lot to do with it. The kids have to some extent, be reminded that if there's anything like seeing stars, they have to tell the coach, and they have to but then there's also a problem, isn't there, Dr. Freitag, in some of these coaches being reluctant where their star players are concerned, and telling them, you know, go on and buck up and be a man or woman about it, whatever the case may be?
Well, you would certainly hope not. I think the best coaches that I've run across, one coach that I've come across, he says that I don't coach football players. I coach future doctors, future school teachers, future, you know, whatever.
Very thoughtful coach. They're not all in that category.
And there's bad apples in every sport. And that's why you'd hope through education and understanding. And it is a top-down approach. The coach sets the culture, but then you also want the athletes to look out for their brother or sister on the field, and also for the athletes to recognize there's a competitive advantage to not playing with a concussion. You know, you're going to be slowed down. You might have difficulty remembering plays. You put yourself at greater risk, and even possibly your teammates at greater risk for injury, because if your brain's not functioning right, you're not going to be a very good athlete.
Full disclosure, you know, some people find this hard to believe, but I was a football player in high school, and I remember getting hit pretty hard and taking a fall, and the particular coach said, you know, get up, you know, and I mean, there is that attitude still that's out there in a lot of contact sports. It's not only get up, but you internalize the idea that you have to do that. You have to do it for the team. You have to do it for yourself. You're going to lose your place on the team. I mean, we're talking about really very profound cultural kinds of I use a big word, shibboleths, you know, where these activities are concerned. Don't you see a lot of that, Carlin Center?
You know, the sideline coverage that I do, I would say that maybe because of the increased awareness of concussion, I find the coaches that I work with to be quite understanding. And, you know, they sort of like Eric said, I mean, I think that they take, at the high school level, they take their jobs seriously, you know, from a leadership perspective and really caring for their student-athletes.
Look, I don't want to in any way impugn coaches. I think there's some wonderful coaches out there, and I met some of them.
But you're talking about the culture.
Like
more.
Eric said, there's some bad apples. Yeah, and, you know, I'm a throwback. I mean, I played football many, many years ago, and things have changed, and there's a lot more attention to these kinds of things and a lot more probably sensitivity and empathy. But I still think the culture needs some pretty serious tweaking.
Yeah, I think, you know, the educational part is really key. Again, I think having athletic trainers on the sideline who know their student athletes really well is really key. So that if a student athlete, you know, takes a hard hit, is down on the ground and sort of pops back up and wants to go back in for the next play in that series, if you know that athlete well, taking him to the side real quick and saying, hey, you know, that was a hard hit. How are you feeling? Kind of quiz them a bit and tracking them down. Because it is true, football and other sports, but football in particular, fast-paced game, and sometimes you need to know your student-athletes really well, like a trainer does, and kind of be a little bit more assertive about asking them about how they're doing.
Here's a caller, Maud. Join us. Maud, hi.
Hi. I'm a physician who sees quite a few brain injury patients. I also had a son who had a brain injury. And a lot of brain injuries that keep going are actually a plumbing problem. People don't realize that fluid and the toxicity in the brain causes swelling, inflammation, and hurts the brain more. And a lot of times with these traumas, the exits for the fluid and the toxicity in the frontal lobe, in the posterior area, are shut down. And one of the things as a cranial osteopath I do is open up these channels. So most of my patients who had pretty severe brain injuries recover much more quickly. And I think if more people realize there actually is treatment, then they're really a little more willing to take the time to rest, to get treatment, to deal with the plumbing issues and the distortions in the brain itself, because the brain is beating about 8 times a minute. And when it gets a concussion, it just shuts down. And so it's actually fairly easy to diagnose a concussion once you're trained to feel these pulsations in the brain.
Well, I appreciate your call. Carlin Center, you are not an osteopath. You're an MD, although osteopaths are recognized as physicians in the state of California. But what do you think about this notion of plumbing and diagnosis related to that?
Yeah, no, it's interesting, and I appreciate the information. I haven't, I don't know much about it, and I think that comes from a difference in training as far as osteopathic medicine, but really interesting points.
And I thank Maud for the call, and we'll go to another call, and that's you, Lori. Hi, welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Michael. It actually is a good segue from what you were saying about having been a football player years ago, and my dad was the eye doctor for the University of Miami Hurricanes for more than 45 years, and he was constantly trying to get the coaches and trainers to learn about concussions in those years. As late as 2003, when Miami went to the national championship, and many people feel that that college football game was the greatest in all history, Kenny Dorsey, who came subsequently to the 49ers, was the quarterback, and in the second overtime, he got a concussion that my dad recognized and was trying to tell the coaches, he says he's fine, but don't put him back in. He's not fine. And my dad was an optometrist trying to teach these doctors who are on the medical staff and the coaches and the trainers that he was not fine. He went back in and threw an interception, and Miami lost this major championship. There's a huge impact that we can trace over decades, literally and metaphorically, impact on major sporting events and everything. If the coaches and trainers would pull out these athletes, they would often win these games because the athletes say they're fine. They think they're fine, but they're absolutely not fine. And many of the eye doctors were the ones who started, optometrists and ophthalmologists, starting to try to educate about this. And hopefully these doctors can collaborate with the optometrist and ophthalmologist to when they're doing the visual training and exams of the student athletes. If there's a coordination, which my dad advocated for decades, but was ignored, they thought he was crazy. But anyway, that's...
Well, your dad was ahead of his time, and he saw things more clearly. Maybe being an optometrist gave him more vision than those physicians. Thank you for that story, Lori. It's an important one. I appreciate it. And I'm going to get another caller on. Lavinia, good morning.
Good morning. I just keep seeing Karen Silkwood in my mind. I mean, there are billions of dollars at stake here. There is no way the football industry is going to supervise itself. And so what is the medical community going to do to protect these kids?
I think that's a vital question, and I'm glad you raised it and have some thoughts on that, either of our guests, Eric Freitag or Carlin Center. You want to go on record here?
Yeah, well, I think just going back to what I said earlier is I think really the first step is education is the key, is that I think you have an obligation if you are a coach or a parent of an athlete to be educated on the signs and symptoms of a concussion and how to appropriately respond. there is state law, California AB 1451, that mandates that high school coaches go through concussion education training every 2 years. And that's a step in the right direction. I would like to see that law expanded over to not just high school, but to all youth sports.
And let me thank the caller and go to some of your emails here. Bruce says, thank you for airing a segment on this issue. A question for the doctors, is there any data that points to a difference in susceptibility correlated to how long a child has been playing football? That is to say, if a teenager has been playing full contact football practically year-round since they were in grade school, does that pose a higher risk of concussion? Eric?
That's a great question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Carlos, I don't – oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I don't know of any strong data out there, Eric. I don't know if you're aware of any, but certainly that's a concern is the sort of, you know, with the NFL risk of dementia being higher, the association there is the concern is, well, is that due to a concussion or subconcussive blows, repetitive head injury over many years?
The email brings up a very good point is that there's no, for a lot of athletes, young athletes, there's no off season anymore. And what we're starting to be more concerned about based on some research is not necessarily total concussions, but also looking at what we call subconcussive blows. You know, these minor traumas, hundreds, if not thousands of times per season can add up. And when you look at an underdeveloped brain, a youth brain, those could potentially cause some problems.
Let me bring some more questions from listeners to both of you. Carlin Center, Chris in Berkeley asks, in girls lacrosse, they don't wear helmets. What's the incidence of concussion in girls lacrosse? And do you think girls should wear helmets in lacrosse?
Yeah, the idea of protective gear is an interesting one in sports medicine. I think, you know, protective gear. So with helmets, we should say that, you know, no helmet so far has been shown to prevent concussion. Football helmets were developed to prevent skull fracture, and they're good at that, but they don't prevent concussion, we know. And unfortunately, there's been good research in this, but nothing so far has turned up to prevent concussion. So though boys wear helmets in lacrosse, it does not prevent them from getting concussion playing lacrosse. I think the other important point about protective gear is you can wear protective gear, but does that actually decrease the risk of harm? You know, you can look at sports and say, well, it actually makes people more aggressive. They play bigger, stronger, faster, and actually the risk goes up. So the answer, you know, protective gear is a good idea, but does it always decrease the risk of harm? Not always.
Well, Dave writes, I had a concussion about 10 years ago. Ever since then, while my reading is fine, my typing and spelling a riddle with reversed letters. This can happen several times in a sentence, and a person reading my unedited text would think I'm dyslexic. Is this a common result? Eric Freitag?
I would have to know more about the emailer's amount of concussions that they've had, you know, what sort of symptoms they had, how long their symptoms lasted. Is that a common result? I would say no.
You don't see that much dyslexia.
No. The fact of the matter is that the brain actually, if we give it time to heal and give it time to recover and don't expose it to additional injury while it is recovering, the brain does a really good job of healing from these injuries, and that's why it's so important that athletes are removed from play. But if you get further injuries, you get a compounding effect, and that can be a problem. I find in my practice, and this is why I love working with athletes, is that the overwhelming majority of these athletes are, you know, feeling better, back to normal within a matter of weeks. And returning back to their sports without any further difficulty.
Well, in light of that, I'm going to put a heavy question on you from a listener named John who says, what do you advise parents who are trying to decide whether or not to allow their children to play football?
Ooh. Carlin, you want to take that?
Well, he passed the buck.
No.
All right, I can start. You know, I think the jury's really out. I mean, I think Eric and I both have this conversation with parents frequently, and there's no right answer. I don't have any evidence to make me feel that I should say no. No children should be playing football. You know, I watch a lot of high school football. I'm a team doctor. I'm out there, and so I don't think the data is there to really say that. As Eric said, the majority of high school sports concussion cases resolve without issue, and that's been true for years and years. So. In light of the new data, though, I think it does cause us pause, and particularly when you have a student-athlete with a number of injuries and you see that, you know, they're getting injured with less and less force and the symptoms are lasting longer each time. They have to miss more school. They have to miss their sport. And that's when I really sit down with a parent and their child and say, okay, you want to return to football, is there a lower risk sport that we can choose?
Well, my mother didn't want me to play football, and I was injured, but then she came to a game. This is a funny story I've never told on air. And so I recovered a fumble, and she was thrilled because everybody said, hey, your son recovered a fumble, and what a big deal they were making out of it. And then she said, Michael, you recovered a bumble. That's right. Anyway, you think kids' recreational soccer league should ban headers, David in Berkeley asks.
You know, soccer was my main sport. I played it through high school, through college, and a little bit beyond that. And I've coached it for a number of years. I coach my young sons in it. And I have an evolving opinion on that. I believe there's room, especially for the youngest of soccer players, you know, under age 13 or 14. I'm not necessarily advocate banning headers, but I think there needs to be some risk modification. I think we need to limit the headers as much as possible during practices because they're not without consequences. I mean, there are a little minor or micro traumatic event when you head the ball, and not one is not going to cause any damage, but hundreds over the course of a season, if not thousands over the course of a season, can potentially. And there is interesting research showing that there are actual structural changes in the brain occurring with athletes who head the ball very frequently during a season. And like I said, so for some of these athletes, even at 10 or 11 years old, there is no off season, so they're playing all year round, and there might be some consequences with that.
Well, we raised this question about should parents allow kids to play football, and here's another voice that I wanted to bring in. Bradley writes in an email, does anyone really care? Professional football is a direct replacement for Roman gladiators, where the fans do not truly care about the physical impacts or lives of those playing. Indeed, some sick human desire that humans haven't evolved from still enjoys this bloodlust. Ask the players, would they do it over again? They almost all say yes. They're doing it to themselves and they love it. So why should I care? I can tell you this, my 3-month-old son will never play football. I even wonder about soccer with the number of headers they take. Well, one can understand, I suppose. Sandra from Bodega Bay says, have any of the members of the panel heard of Bowen work? It is a gentle soft tissue relaxation technique that can accelerate the body's ability to recover from trauma and particularly brain injuries. I have personally worked with post-concussion clients and seen very positive results. Is there a way to set up some research with any of your guests to evaluate Bowen work's efficacy in sports-related concussions? Either of you heard of this?
I have not, Carlin.
No? Okay.
No, I haven't.
But
if
I could, the emailer brings up an interesting point in that a lot of symptoms, and I think Carlin finds this probably more than I do, is that a lot of symptoms of concussion can actually be caused from cervical spinal trauma or neck trauma, you know, the whiplash effect. And some of those symptoms, the headache and the fatigue, could be actually from neck injury. And we find that if you actually address that and treat that, then a lot of these, quote, post-concussion syndromes clear up. Carlin, do you find that in your practice?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the sort of neck process, also the dizziness and the vertigo, the balance issues are all potentially treatable through rehab, and we do work with a physical therapist on those things.
Well, let me thank you, Carlin Center and Eric Freitag, for being with us. Also, Pratik Mukherjee and Nate Jackson, who were both with us earlier. And you are listeners, of course. In fact, we're going to do what we do occasionally on Fridays in just a moment. But I want to mention that for more on concussions in sports, you can turn into a special frontline program, League of Denial, the NFL's Concussion Crisis, which will air on Tuesday, October 8th at 9 p.m. on KQED Public Television 9. And on Thursday, October 17th, you can join KQED for a screening of the frontline special, followed by a panel discussion with Bay Area experts and former National Football League players. That event will be held from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Kaiser Center, 300 Lakeside Drive in Oakland. Now, it's time again for our mailbag segment when we read from our listeners' comments and read your feedback. First up, Doug, who emailed to say that our show on the rimfire burning in and around Yosemite National Park gave a false image of catastrophic fire in Sierra Forest. He went on to say, fire is a natural and healthy part of California's forest ecosystems. The latest science shows that current forest fires, such as the Rim Fire, are not unnaturally severe and that having more fire, including some large, intense fires, is beneficial for our forests. By taking fire-safe steps around houses, Sierra communities can safely coexist with the natural fire cycles rather than trying to change the forest through expensive and damaging large-scale logging and fire suppression. And our show with a pair of reporters who investigated lax oversight and follow-through on claims of elder abuse in California drew some passionate comments. Juna wrote, "As a nurse, this problem is beyond appalling, and I believe it should be addressed by us, the nursing community. The situation is more complicated than pointing fingers and punishing the abusive staff. Obviously, there are nursing staff that do not deserve their licenses, and some should be jailed for their actions. However, I would think it would make sense to look at the conditions the staff are working under. I bet they are overly stressed, working too hard for too little." And regarding our show on the California legislative session coming to a close, Rick from Palo Alto sent in this comment about some of the new gun control legislation proposed for California. "My son graduated from Cal Poly with honors thanks to a scholarship provided by an Army ROTC program, and as part of that program, he fought in Afghanistan earlier this year. He owns some of the weapons that have been made illegal, and what I see is that his state, my state, is telling him, either you sell these weapons before you return or we will jail you. Meanwhile, my daughter lives in San Francisco in the Mission District, where two times in the last year there have been murders on her street, both times by gang members who had unlicensed weapons. This, to me, shows the fallacy of this legislation. To me, this is the left putting a stick in the eye of slightly less than half of our state." And on Monday, during our show with Stanford historian David Kennedy about his book, The Modern American Military, a listener wrote to ask about deaths of civilian military contractors, and we followed up with ProPublica, an online nonprofit newsroom that does investigative journalism. As of December 2012, 3,258 civilian contract workers had been killed or died in Iraq, and another 90,000 had reported injuries, and those numbers were based on reports from the U.S. Department of Labor. Thank you again to you, our listeners, for your continued feedback. You can hear all of the shows mentioned in our archives at kqed.org/forum, and if you have a comment or a show suggestion, email it to us, forum@kqed.org. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and the executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our interns are Keelan Cronin, Nick Zabrowski, Victor Valle, Angela Johnston, and Aaron Newport. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.